Chapter 12. The season made the Sea of the Winds extremely hazardous, and Geryon was forced to wait for a full month before he could dispatch a messenger to the Vale of Aldur. By then, the late autumn snowstorms had clogged the passes in the mountains of eastern Sindaria, and the royal messenger was obliged literally to wade his way across the plains of Algeria. With all of these delays, it was very nearly Erastide by the time Aunt Paul, Durnick, and Erand arrived at the snowy quay in the harbor of Riva. Durnick admitted to Geryon that it had only been a chance meeting with the wayward Captain Greldick, who feared no storm that any sea could hurl at him, that had made the trip possible at all. Polgara spoke briefly with the vagabond seaman before they began the long climb up to the citadel, and Geryon noted with some surprise that Greldick slipped his hawsers immediately and sailed back out to sea. Polgara seemed quite unconcerned about the gravity of the problem that had impelled Geryon to send for her. She spoke with him only a couple of times about it, asking a few rather direct questions that set his ears to flaming. Her discussions with Tenedra were a bit more lengthy, but only slightly so. Geryon received the distinct impression that she was waiting for someone or something before proceeding. The Erastide celebration at Riva that year was somewhat subdued. Although it was very pleasant to have Polgara, Durnick, and Erend with them to join in the festivities, Geryon's concern over the problem Brand had raised dampened his enjoyment of the holiday. Several weeks afterward, Geryon entered the royal apartment one snowy mid-afternoon to find Polgara and Tenedra seated by a cozy fire, sipping tea and chatting together quietly. The curiosity which had been growing in him since the arrival of his visitors finally boiled to a head. "Aunt Paul," he began.
"Yes, dear."
"You have been here for almost a month now."
"Has it been that long? The time certainly passes quickly when you're with people you love."
"There is still this little problem, you know."
"Yes, Geryon," she replied patiently. "I'm aware of that."
"Are we doing anything about it?"
"No," she said placidly. "Not yet, anyhow."
"Well, it is sort of important, Aunt Paul. I don't want to seem to be trying to rush you or anything, but..." He broke off helplessly. Polgar arose from her chair, went to the window, and looked out at the small private garden just outside. The garden was clogged with snow, and the pair of intertwined oak trees Tenedra had planted there at the time of her betrothal to Geryon were bowed slightly beneath the weight on their limbs.
"One of the things you will learn as you grow older, Geryon," she said to him gravely, looking out at the snowy garden, "is patience. Everything has its proper season. The solution to your problem is not all that complicated, but it is not the proper time to come to grips with it yet."
"I don't understand that at all, Aunt Paul."
"Then you will just have to trust me, won't you?"
"Well, of course I trust you, Aunt Paul. It's just..."
"Just what, dear?"
"Nothing." It was late winter before Captain Greldick returned from the south. A storm had sprung one of the seams of his ship, and she was taking water as she wallowed heavily around the headland and made for the quay.
"I thought for a while there that I might have to swim," the bearded Kerrick growled as he jumped across to the quay. "Where's the best place to beach this poor old cow of mine? I'm going to have to caulk the bottom."
"Most sailors use that inlet over there," Geryon replied, pointing.
"I hate to beach a ship in the winter," Greldick said bitterly. "Is there some place where I can get a drink?"
"Up at the Citadel," Geryon offered.
"Thanks. Oh, I brought that visitor that Polgara wanted."
"Visitor?" Greldick stepped back, squinted at his ship to determine the location of the aft cabin, then went over and kicked the planking several times.
"We're here," he bellowed.
He turned back to Geryon.
"I really hate to sail with women on board. I'm not superstitious, but sometimes I really think they do bring bad luck. And you've always got to watch your manners."
"You have a woman on board?" Geryon asked curiously.
Greldick grunted sourly. "Pretty little thing. She seems to expect deferential treatment. And when your whole crew is busy bailing seawater out of your bilges, you don't have that much time for that.
Hello, Garion,
a light voice said from up on the deck.
Zira?
Garion stared up into the small face of his wife's cousin. Is that really you?
Yes, Garion,
the red-haired dryad replied calmly. She was bundled up to the ears in thick, warm furs, and her breath steamed in the frosty air.
I got here as quickly as I could when I received Lady Pulgra's summons.
She smiled sweetly down at the sour-faced Greldick.
Captain, she said, could you have some of your men bring those spears along for me?
Dirt, Greldick snorted. I sail 2,000 leagues in the dead of winter to carry one small girl, 2 casks of water, and 4 bales of dirt.
Loam, Captain,
Zara corrected meticulously.
Loam, there is a difference, you know.
I am a sailor, Greldick said. To me, dirt is dirt.
Whatever you wish, Captain,
Zara said winsomely.
Now do be a dear and have the bales carried up to the citadel for me, and I'll need the casks as well.
Grumbling, Captain Greldick gave the orders. Tenedra was ecstatic when she learned that her cousin had arrived in Riva. The two of them flew into each other's arms and dashed off immediately to find Pulgra.
They're very fond of each other, aren't they?
Dernick observed. The smith was dressed in furs and wore a pair of well-tarred boots. Shortly after his arrival, despite the fact that it was the dead of winter, Dernick had discovered a large swirling pool in the river that dropped out of the mountains and ran just to the north of the city. With astounding self-restraint, he had actually stared at that ice-rimmed pool for a full 10 minutes before going in search of a fishing pole. Now he happily spent most of each day probing those dark, churning waters with a waxed line and a bright lure in search of the silvery-sided salmon that lurked beneath the turbulent surface. The closest Garion had ever seen his Aunt Paul actually come to scolding her husband had been on the day when she had intercepted him on his way out of the citadel into the very teeth of a screaming blizzard, whistling and with his fishing pole over his shoulder.
"What am I supposed to do with all of this?" Greldick demanded, pointing at the 6 burly sailors who had carried Zira's bales and casks up the long stairway to the grim fortress brooding over the city.
"Oh, just have your men put them over there," he pointed toward a corner of the antechamber that they had just entered. "I'll find out what the ladies want done with them later."
Greldick grunted. "Good."
Then he rubbed his hands together.
"Now, about that drink."
Garion did not have the faintest idea what his wife and her cousin and Pulgra were up to. Most of the time, their conversations broke off as soon as he entered the room. To his astonishment, the 4 bales of loam and the 2 casks of what seemed to be water were stacked rather untidily in one corner of the royal bedroom. Tenedra adamantly refused to explain, but the look she gave him when he asked why they needed to be so close to the royal bed was not only mysterious, but actually faintly naughty. It was perhaps a week or two after Zira's arrival that a sudden break in the weather brought the sun out and the temperature soared up to almost freezing. Shortly before noon, Garion was in conference with the Drasnian ambassador when a wide-eyed servant hesitantly entered the royal study.
"Please, Your Majesty," the poor man stammered. "Please forgive me interrupting, but Lady Pulgra told me to bring you to her at once. I tried to tell her that we don't bother you when you're busy, but she sort of insisted."
"You had better go to see what she wants, Your Majesty," the Drasnian ambassador suggested. "If the Lady Pulgra had just summoned me, I would be running toward her door already."
"You don't really have to be afraid of her, Margrave," Garion told him. "She wouldn't actually hurt you."
"That is a chance that I'd prefer not to take, Your Majesty. We can talk about the matter we were discussing some other time."
Frowning slightly, Garion went down the hall to the door of Aunt Paul's apartment. He tapped gently, and then went in.
"Ah, there you are," she said crisply. "I was about to send another servant after you." She wore a fur-lined cloak with a deep hood pulled up until it framed her face. Tenedra and Zira, similarly garbed, were standing just behind her. "I want you to go and find Durnik. He's probably fishing. Find him and bring him back to the Citadel. Get a shovel and a pick from some place, and then bring Durnik and the tools to that little garden just outside your apartment window." He stared at her. She made a kind of flipping motion with one hand. "Quickly, Geryon, quickly, quickly. The day is wearing on." "Yes, Aunt Paul," he said, without even thinking. He turned and went back out, half running. He was nearly to the end of the hallway before he remembered that he was the king here, and that people probably should not order him around like that. Durnik, of course, responded immediately to his wife's summons. Well, almost immediately. He did make one last cast before carefully coiling up his fishing line and following Geryon back to the Citadel. When the two of them entered the small private garden adjoining the royal apartment, Aunt Paul, Tenedra, and Zira were already there, standing beneath the intertwined oak trees. "Here is what we are going to do," Aunt Paul said in a businesslike fashion. "I would like to have the area around these tree trunks opened up to a depth of about 2 feet." "Aunt Paul," Geryon interposed, "the ground is sort of frozen. Digging's going to be a little difficult." "That is what the pick is for, dear," she said patiently. "Wouldn't it be easier to wait until the ground thaws?" "Probably. But it needs to be done now. Dig, Geryon." "I've got gardeners, Aunt Paul. We could send for a couple of them." He eyed the pick and shovel uncomfortably. "It's probably better if we keep it in the family, dear. You can start digging right here," she pointed. Geryon sighed and took up the pick. What followed made no sense at all. Geryon and Durnik picked and spaded at the frozen ground until late afternoon, opening up the area that Aunt Paul had indicated. Then they dumped the 4 bales of loam into the hole that they had prepared, tamped down the loose earth, and watered the dark soil liberally with the water from the 2 casks. After that, Aunt Paul instructed them to cover everything back up again with snow. "Did you understand any of that?" Geryon asked Durnik as the two of them returned their tools to the gardener's shed in the courtyard near the stables.
"No," Durnik admitted. "But I'm sure she knows what she's doing."
He glanced at the evening sky and then sighed.
"It's probably a little late to be going back to the pool," he said regretfully.
Aunt Paul and the 2 girls visited the garden daily, but Geryon could never discover exactly what they were doing. And the following week his attention was diverted by the sudden appearance of his grandfather Belgarath the Sorcerer. The young king was sitting in his study with Erend, as the boy described in some detail the training of the horse Geryon had given him a few years back, when the door banged unceremoniously open, and Belgarath, travel-stained and with a face like a thundercloud, strode in. "Grandfather!" Geryon exclaimed, starting to his feet.
"What are you—" "Shut up and sit down!"
Belgarath shouted at him.
"What?"
"Do as I tell you. We're going to have a talk, Geryon. That is, I am going to talk, and you are going to listen."
He paused as if to get control of what appeared to be a towering anger.
"Do you have any idea what you have done?"
he demanded at last. "Me? What are we talking about, Grandfather?"
"We are talking about your little display of pyrotechnics on the plains of Mimbre," Belgarath replied icily. "That impromptu thunderstorm of yours."
"Grandfather," Geryon explained as mildly as possible, "they were right on the brink of war. All Orendia would probably have gotten involved. You've said yourself that we didn't want that to happen. I had to stop them."
"We are not talking about your motives, Geryon. We are talking about your methods. What possessed you to use a thunderstorm?"
"It seemed like the best way to get their attention."
"You couldn't think of anything else?"
"They were already charging, Grandfather. I didn't have a lot of time to consider the alternatives."
"Haven't I told you again and again that we do not tamper with the weather?
Well, it was sort of an emergency.
If you thought that was an emergency, you should have seen the blizzard you touched off in the Vale with your foolishness, and the hurricanes it spawned in the Sea of the East, not to mention the droughts and tornadoes you've kicked up all over the world. Don't you have any sense of responsibility at all?
I didn't know it was going to do that.
Geryon was aghast.
Boy, it is your business to know, Belgareth suddenly roared at him, his face mottled with rage. It has taken Belden and me 6 months of constant travel, and the gods only know how much effort, to quiet things down. Do you realize that with one of the thoughtless storms of yours you came very close to changing the weather patterns of this entire globe? And that change would have been a universal disaster.
One tiny little storm?
Yes, one tiny little storm, Belgareth said scathingly. Your one tiny little storm in the right place at the right time came very close to altering the weather for the next several aeons all over the world, you blockhead.
Grandfather,
Geryon protested,
do you know what the term Ice Age means?
Geryon shook his head, his face blank.
It is a time when the average temperature drops just a bit. In the extreme north, that means that the snow doesn't melt in the summer. It keeps piling up year after year. It forms glaciers, and the glaciers start to move farther and farther south. In just a few centuries, that little display of yours could have had a wall of ice 200 feet high moving down across the moors of Dresnia. You would have buried Boktor and Val'Elorn under solid ice, you idiot. Is that what you wanted?
Well, of course not, Grandfather. I honestly didn't know. I wouldn't have started it if I'd have known.
Oh, that would have been a great comfort to the millions of people you very nearly entombed in ice.
Belgareth retorted with vast sarcasm.
Don't ever do that again. Don't even think about putting your hands on something until you are absolutely certain you know everything there is to know about it. Even then, it is best not to gamble.
But you and Aunt Paul called down the rainstorm in the woods of the Dryads,
Geryon pointed out defensively.
We knew what we were doing,
Belgareth almost screamed.
There was no danger there.
With an enormous effort, the old man got control of himself.
Don't ever touch the weather again, Geryon. Not until you have had at least 1,000 years of study.
1,000 years?
At least. In your case, maybe 2,000. You seem to have this extraordinary luck. You always manage to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I won't do it again, Grandfather,
Geryon promised fervently, shuddering at the thought of towering ice walls creeping inexorably across the world. Belgareth gave him a long, hard look and then let the matter drop. Later, when he had regained his composure, he lounged in a chair by the fire with a tankard of ale in one hand. Geryon knew his grandfather well enough to be aware of the fact that ale mellowed the old man's disposition, and he had prudently sent for some as soon as the initial explosion had subsided.
"How are your studies going, boy?"
the old sorcerer asked.
"I have been a little pressed for time lately, Grandfather."
Belgareth gave him a long, cold stare, and Geryon could clearly see the mottling on his neck that indicated that the old man's interior temperature was rising again.
"I am sorry, Grandfather," he apologized quickly. "From now on, I'll make the time to study."
Belgareth's eyes widened slightly.
"Don't do that,"
he said quickly.
"You got into enough trouble fooling around with the weather. If you start in on time, not even the gods could predict the outcome."
"I didn't exactly mean it that way, Grandfather."
"Well, say what you mean, then. This is not a good area for misunderstandings, you know."
He turned his attention then to Erend.
"What are you doing here, boy?"
"Durnik and Polgara are here,"
Erend replied.
"They thought I ought to come along."
"Polgara's here?"
Belgareth seemed surprised.
"I asked her to come,"
Geryon told him.
"There's a little bit of a problem that she's fixing for me.
At least, I think she's fixing it. She's been acting sort of mysterious.
Oh, she over-dramatizes things sometimes. Exactly what is this problem she's working on?
Geryon glanced at Erend, who sat watching the two of them with polite interest. Geryon flushed slightly.
It has to do with the heir to the Riven throne, he explained delicately.
What's the problem there? Belgrath demanded obtusely. You are the heir to the Riven throne.
No, I mean the next one.
I still don't see any problem.
Grandfather, there isn't one. Not yet, at least.
There isn't? What have you been doing, boy?
Never mind, Geryon said, giving up.
When spring arrived at last, Polgara's attention to the two embracing oak trees became all-consuming. She went to the garden at least a dozen times a day to examine every twig meticulously for signs of budding. When at last the twig ends began to swell, a look of strange satisfaction became apparent on her face. Once again, she and the two young women, Tenedra and Zira, began puttering in the garden. Geryon found all of these botanical pastimes baffling, even a little irritating. He had, after all, asked Aunt Paul to come to Reva to deal with a much more serious problem. Zira returned home to the Wood of the Dryads at the first break in the weather. Not long afterward, Aunt Paul calmly announced that she and Durnik and Erend would also be leaving soon. "We will take Father with us," she declared, looking disapprovingly over at the old sorcerer, who was drinking ale and bantering outrageously with Bran's niece, the blushing Lady Errol. "Aunt Paul," Geryon protested, "what about that little, difficulty Tenedra and I were having?"
"What about it, dear?"
"Aren't you going to do something about it?"
"I did, Geryon," she replied blandly.
"Aunt Paul, you spent all of your time in that garden."
"Yes, dear, I know."
Geryon brooded about the whole matter for several weeks after they had all left. He even began to wonder if he had somehow failed to explain fully the problem or if Aunt Paul had somehow misunderstood. When spring was in full flower and the meadows rising steeply behind the city had turned bright green, touched here and there with vibrantly colored patches of wildflowers, Tenedra began behaving peculiarly. He frequently found her seated in the garden, looking with an awed and tender expression at her oak trees, and quite often she was gone from the citadel entirely, to return at the end of the day in the company of Lady Errol, all bedecked with wildflowers. Before each meal she took a sip from a small silver flagon and made a dreadful face.
"What is that you're drinking?" he asked her curiously one morning. "It is a sort of tonic," she replied, shuddering. "It has oak buds in it, and it tastes absolutely vile."
"Aunt Paul made it for you."
"How did you know that?"
"Her medicines always taste awful."
"Hmm,"
she said absently. Then she gave him a long look.
"Are you going to be very busy today?"
"Not really. Why?"
"I thought we might stop by the kitchen and pick up some meat and bread and cheese and then go spend a day out in the forest."
"In the forest? What for?"
"Geryon,"
she said almost crossly,
"I have been cooped up in this dreary old castle all winter. I'd like some fresh air and sunshine, and the smell of trees and wildflowers around me instead of this damp stone."
"Why don't you ask Errol to go with you? I probably shouldn't really be gone all day." She gave him an exasperated look.
"You just said that you didn't have anything important to do."
"Well, you never know. Something might come up."
"It can wait,"
she said from between clenched teeth. Geryon shot her a quick glance, recognized the danger signals, and then replied as mildly as he could, "I suppose you're right, dear. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't have a little outing together. We could ask Errol and maybe Kale if they'd like to join us."
"No, Geryon,"
she said quite firmly.
"No? Definitely not."
And so it was that shortly after breakfast, the Raven King, hand in hand with his little queen, left the citadel with a well-stocked basket, crossed the broad meadow behind the city, and strolled into the sunlight-dappled shade beneath the evergreens that mounted steeply toward the glistening snow-capped peaks that formed the spine of the island. Once they entered the woods, all traces of discontent dropped away from Zenedra's face. She picked wildflowers as they wandered among the tall pines and firs, and wove them into a garland for herself. The morning sun slanted down through the limbs high overhead, dappling the mossy forest floor with golden light and blue shadow. The resinous smell of the tall evergreens was a heady perfume, and birds swooped and spiraled among the tall column-like trunks, caroling to greet the sun. After a time, they found a glade, a mossy open clearing embraced by the trees, where a brook gurgled and murmured over shining stones to drop into a gleaming forest pool, and where a single soft-eyed deer stood to drink. The deer raised her head from the water, swirling about her delicate brown legs, looked at them quite unafraid, and then picked her way back into the forest, her hooves clicking on the stones and her tail flicking.
"Oh, this is just perfect," Zenedra declared,
with a soft little smile on her face. She sat on a round boulder and began to unlace her shoes. Geryon put down the basket and stretched, feeling the cares of the past several weeks slowly draining out of him.
"Oh, I am glad you thought of this," he said, sprawling comfortably on the sun-warmed moss. "It is really very good to be here. It's a good idea."
"Naturally," she said. "All of my ideas are good ones."
"Well, I don't know if I'd go that far."
Then a thought occurred to him. "Zenedra."
"What?"
"I've been meaning to ask you something. All the dryads have names that begin with an X, don't they? Zira, Xantha, like that."
"It is our custom,"
she replied, continuing to work on her shoelaces.
"Why doesn't yours, then? Begin with an X, I mean."
"It does."
She pulled off one of the shoes.
"The Netherlands just pronounce it a little differently, that's all. So they spell it that way. Dryads don't read or write very much, so they don't worry too much about spelling."
"Xnedra?"
"Well, that's fairly close. Make the X a little softer, though."
"You know, I've been wondering about that for the longest time."
"Why didn't you ask, then?"
"I don't know. I just never got around to it."
"There is a reason for everything, Geryon. But you'll never find out if you don't ask."
"Now you sound just like Aunt Paul."
"Yes, dear, I know."
She smiled at him, pulled off her other shoe, and wriggled her toes contentedly.
"Why barefoot?" he asked idly.
"I like the feel of the moss on my feet. And I think that, in a little bit, I might go swimming."
"It's too cold. That brook comes right out of a glacier."
"A little cold water won't hurt me,"
she shrugged. Then, almost as if responding to a dare, she stood up and began to take off her clothes.
"Zenedra, what if someone comes along?"
She laughed a silvery little laugh.
"So what if they do? I'm not going to soak my clothes just for the sake of propriety. Don't be such a prude, Geryon."
"Well, it's not that. It's..."
"It's what?"
"Never mind."
She ran on light feet into the pool, squealing delightedly as the icy water splashed up around her. With a long, clean dive, she disappeared beneath the surface of the pool, swam to the far side, where a large mossy log angled down into the crystal-clear water, and surfaced with streaming hair and an impish grin.
"Well?"
"Well, what?"
"Aren't you coming in?"
"Of course I'm not."
"Is the mighty overlord of the West afraid of cold water?"
"The mighty overlord of the West has better sense than to catch cold for the sake of a little splashing around."
"Geryon, you are getting positively stodgy. Take off your crown and relax."
"I'm not wearing my crown."
"Take off something else, then."
"Zenedra."
She laughed another silvery peal of laughter and began kicking her bare feet, sending up showers of sparkling water drops that gleamed like jewels in the mid-morning sunlight. Then she lay back, and her hair spread like a deep copper fan upon the surface of the pool. The garland of flowers she had woven for herself earlier had come apart as a result of her swimming, and the individual blossoms floated on the water, bobbing in the ripples. Geryon sat on a mossy hummock with his back resting comfortably against a tree trunk. The sun was warm, and the smell of trees and grass and wild flowers filled his nostrils. A breeze carrying the salt tang of the sea sighed among the green limbs of the tall fir trees surrounding the little glade, and golden sunlight fell in patches on the floor of the forest. An errant butterfly, its patterned wings a blaze of iridescent blue and gold, flitted out from among the tall tree trunks into the sunlight. Drawn by color or scent or some other more mysterious urge, it wavered through the lucid air to the pool and the flowers bobbing there. Curiously, it moved from flower to floating flower, touching each of them lightly with its wings. With a breathless expression, Tenedra slowly sank her head into the water until only her upturned face was above the surface. The butterfly continued its curious investigations, coming closer and closer to the waiting queen. Then it hovered over her face, its soft wings brushing her lips ecstatically. "Oh, fine," Geryon laughed. "Now my wife is consorting with butterflies."
"I will do whatever it takes in order to get a kiss,"
she replied, giving him an arch look. "If it's kisses you want, I'll take care of that for you."
"Oh, that is an interesting thought. I think I'd like one right now. My other lover seems to have lost interest."
She pointed at the butterfly, which had settled with quivering wings on a bush near the foot of the pool.
"Come and kiss me, Geryon."
"You're right in the middle of the deepest part of the pool," he pointed out.
"So?"
"I don't suppose you would consider coming out."
"You offered kisses, Geryon. You did not make any conditions."
Geryon sighed, stood up, and began to remove his clothing. "We're both going to regret this," he predicted. "A cold in the summertime lasts for months."
"You're not going to catch cold, Geryon. Come along now."
He groaned, and then waded manfully into the icy water. "Oh, you're a cruel woman, Tenedra," he accused, wincing at the shocking chill.
"Well, don't be such a baby. Come over here."
Gritting his teeth, he plowed through the water toward her, stubbing his toe on a large rock in the process. When he reached her, she slid her cold little wet arms around his neck and glued her lips to his. Her kiss was lingering, and it pulled him slightly off balance. He felt her lips tighten slightly as she grinned impishly, even in the midst of the kiss, and then, without any warning, she lifted her legs and her weight pulled him under. He came up sputtering and swearing.
"Wasn't that fun?"
"Not really. Drowning isn't one of my favorite sports." She ignored that.
"Well, now that you are all wet, you might as well swim with me."
They swam together for about a quarter of an hour, and then emerged from the pool, shivering and with their lips turning blue.
"Oh, make a fire, Geryon,"
Tenedra said through chattering teeth. I didn't bring any tinder, nor a flint."
"Well, do it the other way, then."
"What other way?"
"You know."
She made a sort of mysterious gesture. "Oh, I forgot about that."
"Hurry, Geryon, I'm freezing."
He gathered some twigs and fallen branches, cleared a space in the moss, and concentrated his will on the pile of wood. At first, a small tendril of smoke arose, then a tongue of bright orange flame. Within a few minutes, a goodly little fire was crackling just beside the moss-covered hummock upon which the shivering Tenedra was huddled.
"Oh, that is much better,"
she said, stretching her hands out to the fire.
"You are a useful person to have around, my lord."
"Thank you, my lady. Would my lady like to consider putting on some clothes?"
Mm-mm, not until she is dry, she wouldn't. I hate pulling on dry clothes over wet skin.
Well, let's hope nobody comes along, then. We're not really dressed for company, you know.
You are so conventional, Geryon.
I suppose so, he admitted.
Why don't you come over here beside me?
She invited.
It is much warmer here.
He couldn't really think of any reason why he shouldn't, so he joined her on the warm moss.
See?
She said, putting her arms about his neck.
Isn't this much nicer?
She kissed him, a serious kind of kiss that made his breath catch in his throat and his heart pound. When she finally released her grip about his neck, he looked around the glade nervously. A fluttering movement near the foot of the pool caught his eye. He coughed, looking slightly embarrassed.
What is the matter?
She asked him.
I think that butterfly is watching, he said with a slight flush.
That's all right,
she smiled, sliding her arms about his neck and kissing him again. The world seemed unusually quiet as spring gently slipped into summer that year. The secession of the Vordus crumbled under the onslaughts of the armored Membrate brigands, and the Vordu family finally capitulated, pleading with an almost genuine humility to be readmitted to the Empire. While they were not fond of Arana's tax collectors, they all ran out into the streets to greet his legions as they returned. The news from Tol Mirgos was sketchy at best, but it appeared that things in the far south remained at an impasse with Kalzakath's Malorians holding the plains and Urgut's Mirgos firmly entrenched in the mountains. Periodic reports forwarded to Geryon by Drasnian intelligence seemed to indicate that the re-emergent bear cult was doing little more than milling around out in the countryside. Geryon enjoyed this respite from crisis, and since there was no really pressing business, he took to sleeping late, sometimes lying in bed in a kind of luxurious doze until 2 or 3 hours past sunrise. On one such morning about midsummer, he was having an absolutely splendid dream. He and Tenedra were leaping from the loft in the barn at Faldor's farm into the soft hay piled below. He was awakened rather rudely, as his wife bolted from the bed and ran into an adjoining chamber where she was violently and noisily sick. "Tenedra!" he exclaimed, jumping out of the bed to follow her. "What are you doing?"
"I'm throwing up,"
she replied, raising her pale face from the basin she was holding on her knees. "Are you sick?"
"No,"
she drawled sarcastically.
"I'm doing it for fun."
"I'll get one of the physicians," he said, grabbing up a robe.
"Never mind."
"But you were sick."
"Of course I am, but I don't need a physician."
"That doesn't really make any sense, Enedra. If you are sick, you need a doctor."
"I am supposed to be sick."
"What?"
"Don't you know anything, Geryon? I'll probably get sick every morning for the next several months."
"I don't understand you at all, Tenedra."
"You are impossibly dense. People in my condition always get sick in the morning."
"Condition? What condition?" She rolled her eyes upward, almost in despair.
"Geryon,"
she said with exaggerated patience,
"do you remember that little problem we had last fall? The problem that made us send for Lady Pulgara?"
"Well, yes."
"I am so glad. Well, we don't have that problem anymore."
He stared at her, slowly comprehending.
"You mean..." "Yes, dear,"
she said with a pale smile.
"You are going to be a father. No, if you'll excuse me, I think I'll throw up again."